Netcasting from Chicago, Los Angeles, and Sydney, you're listening to this week's FX Podcast from FXGuide.com.
Available now from FXPhD.com, all new speed grade fast forward training. Download immediately all 10 classes and footage covering CS6 speed grade. Check it out at FXPhD.com.
Thanks for joining us for this FX podcast. This podcast is where we talk one-on-one with top visual effects artists doing cutting-edge work. We dig deep into the technical side, advance the craft of visual effects, and pay respect to the hardworking people creating amazing work. This podcast is your opportunity to hear directly from the source, from the front lines of visual effects. Be sure to check out our other podcasts at fxguide.com/podcasts. Today, Mike Seymour is going to talk with Paul Debevic, Associate Director, Graphics Research at USC's Institute for Creative Technologies. This is a follow-up to a paper that was presented at SIGGRAPH 2012 that Mike attended. We're all pretty familiar with shooting HDRs on set by now. The process can be time-consuming, or should I say, time on set is so precious that anything we can do to speed up the footprint visual effects creates is a good thing. So normally we would shoot multiple exposures on a mirror ball and a gray ball, or maybe use a fisheye, but all of this takes time. This research is aimed to provide a one-shot solution. One picture taken with a standard DSLR, and you get an HDR out. Basically, the mirror ball and multiple exposures is replaced with a special ball, which contains gray ball in the form of strips around a mirror ball, along with color references, little squares, and then a whole bunch of really smart math. This was a paper that Mike saw at SIGGRAPH and wanted to know more about, so let's jump now to Mike Seymour talking directly with Paul Debevic.
So, Paul, thanks so much for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Always great to talk, Mike.
So, many times I've spoken to you, and you seem to have come up with another way to completely confound and confuse me as you've taken an entire shortcut in what seems to be an incredibly difficult problem and produced results that are, if not mathematically, then certainly optically, very, very close to the test case. And you've done it again with the group, which was presented at SIGGRAPH, with this idea of a single shot light probe. Now, if someone had spoken to me before SIGGRAPH, I would have said, with perhaps one exception, which I know is a work you did in the past, that everybody knows you bracket shots to do HDRs, and you don't get it off one shot with the limited dynamic range standard SLR, and yet there you guys go and did it.
It was something that seemed like it would be useful. I still think you can get your best HDR by shooting bracketed exposures, you know, ideally with a, you know, high-res camera and a fisheye lens, and you aim it into 0, 120, 240, and you stitch it together nicely. That's certainly the highest resolution that you might want to get. But, you know, I was just motivated by the fact that, you know, when you're on set, you want to take as little time as possible to document the light and then make it so that you can convincingly put your photoreal digital face into the scene for a face replacement, or, you know, put your digital transformer or boxing robot in there so it looks like it's really reflecting the light of the scene and drops in. But if you could just really run onto set, just hold something where the character needs to go and then run off. And in fact, if you could even just shoot it with the same camera that's shooting the background plate, that is in fact your principal camera, that would be more convenient than the current processes that are there.
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting aspects about that. The idea of being able to shoot it with the camera is, of course, incredibly relevant because it does give you some idea of what's possibly happening to the image afterwards. And this also is going to touch on something else to do with color space when we get to that part. But just to walk from the outset, obviously, if we were going down the path of doing a mirror ball as opposed to, say, putting an 8mm on a 5D and doing a bracketed fisheye, I expect that what I want is to get a range of exposures, because the whole point of a high dynamic range frame, and I'm telling you this, is that it has a higher dynamic range than standard photography. So, of course, most people listening to this will say, well, a single shot is almost by definition not going to be an HDR. Can you explain how you solve this fundamental dilemma?
Well, the problem really is that you do want to get full HDR of the scene, because if you clip the highlights in the scene, which are going to be, you know, most frequently your light sources or the sky, you're just going to miss that light. You won't know what the color and intensity of those illumination sources are. You'll still accurately record all the indirect light that might be bouncing from the walls or the ground. And since that takes up quite a bit of area, that's still going to contribute significantly to the appearance of your digital object that you're putting in there. So you certainly don't want to miss that, or it won't look very convincing. But, you know, if you chop off those light sources, then you're going to have a problem. But frequently what's happening is that once you have those light sources and their color and intensity correct, then the lighting algorithm is then going to compute new illumination on the scene, which includes, you know, diffuse surfaces and specular surfaces. But these will frequently involve, you know, effectively convolving that back down to blurry reflections. So the idea was that if we could photograph simultaneously not just the mirrored sphere, but also a diffuse sphere, we could figure out from information on the diffuse sphere what the colors and intensities of any of those clip light sources must be, so that then if you then reconstruct the HDRI map, it would then light diffuse surfaces correctly, specular surfaces correctly, and anything in between correctly, and then you have a useful measurement of the illumination that will get you the result you need for your composite.
Okay, so now just to jump in there for 1 second. So, in fact, I'm going to say 3 or 4 years ago, I think you presented this, maybe even longer, this idea that if I had a gray ball, I could actually do some maths that would actually let me work out what the highlights would have to be, almost on as long as the files are linear and you're not doing some weird gammas and stuff. And part of that is that just predicated on the idea that, of course, the gray ball itself is absolutely not clipping, and so you have some kind of reference.
Exactly, yeah. If you know, you put a gray ball in the scene and it's actually, the camera's actually set to you know, record people in the scene at a reasonable exposure, then your you know, 18% gray ball, or I think we used a 30% gray ball, very unlikely to clip on the sensor. And in fact, it was 9 years ago in the SIGGRAPH 2003 course notes for the image-based lighting course that we gave, I actually you know, threw together a some material of putting some virtual objects in front of the Guggenheim Bilbao.
That's right. Yep.
And I had shot a mirrored sphere there. I had my friend Teddy Kim was there, who then held a diffuse sphere in the scene. And it's obviously very common to shoot both diffuse and mirrored spheres when you're out there doing a lighting reference, just to have good reference for these things. But it's actually computationally possible in the case there where there was a sun and the sun clipped in the mirrored sphere to figure out how much light was missing from the sun in its red channel, green channel, and blue channel based on the appearance of the diffuse sphere. And in fact, you know, the math can be set up as, you know, a system of linear equations and such, but really all that the maths are doing is that it's figuring out just how bright of a sun source do you need to stick in the scene so that that, plus the lighting that you did get off of the clipped mirrored ball, the clipped light probe image, effectively would light a diffuse ball the way that the real diffuse ball looked in the scene, if that makes sense.
So in other words, the mirror ball was saying to you, hey, basically this is where the lights are kind of at based on a reflection. The diffuse ball would not be very good for determining direction. It obviously gives you an approximate direction, but it does definitely not clip out. So you can just sort of reverse engineer what that otherwise clipped mirror ball is doing. Now, if that's a given, what's new at the show is that, I guess, to mix my metaphors, that kind of sat on the shelf, I guess, for the last 9 years, because now at the show, you've sort of taken that out and said, okay, hang on, maybe we could sort of combine this into a one-click wonder. So explain to me how this new ball actually physically looks and how it's built.
The design of the new ball was really trying to think of how can we get a diffuse ball and a mirrored ball in the same place, because if you put them right next to each other to photograph them in one shot, then they kind of reflect each other. and there'll be occlusions. That's not a good thing. You can put them further apart, but then they're going to show up small in your shot, and they're going to end up at the edges of your image, which isn't your best optical. You really want to put it right in the center. And so the idea was, or the observation was that, you know, a diffuse ball is such a blurry convolution of the incident light that not every single surface normal of your diffuse ball tells a different story. Whereas on your mirrored ball, every surface normal does have its own story to tell because it'll be reflecting a different part of the environment. Whereas those cosine-weighted hemispherical diffuse integrals that you're observing on the diffuse ball are very dependent on each other from one spot on the ball to the other. So once you realize you don't need to see every point on the diffuse ball, maybe just a sampling of them, then it starts seeming like maybe if we just kind of maybe cracked open our mirrored ball a little bit and made some space for some diffuse strips, we'd be able to get all the information we need in one go. So as it turns out, I'd gotten a number of these hollow, I think around 80 millimeter diameter chrome spheres, and I had enough of them to send them out to be milled so that we could have quadrants that we could split up and then make basically a plus sign of diffuse material in between. One of my colleagues, Professor Mark Bolas at the ICT, gave some good advice about how to actually get this metal milled in the right way. And in fact, I chose to have a little bit more than just the quadrants. It's actually 53% from one side of the sphere into a little past the equator that each one of the quadrants forms. And so as a result, you actually see every single surface normal that you would have seen on the original mirrored sphere. And at this edge that you're opening up, which otherwise could cause a nasty seam, you actually have a blend region of double coverage from one quadrant to the next. And then
just to give a mental picture for somebody if they haven't seen the image, if you took an orange and cut it into quarters, and then instead of putting it back together to look like a normal orange, you kept the orange so that you could put your finger between any one of the four quadrants. Of course, that would be the principle, but you're saying is that you actually had to use multiple oranges because the quadrants are actually slightly bigger than from being them the same orange. So there is overlap when you do, in fact, mathematically just put them back together again.
Yeah, in theory, you could do it with just two spheres and you could pull two of these extra size quadrants out of it. But the milling person that we wanted this to do the job, of course, quite quickly from said, no, just send me four spheres and I know I can get it done. Unfortunately, then I found that my supplier of the mirrored spheres didn't have them anymore after I'd gone and had four of my nice ones all cut up. But we're finding another supplier at this point.
So because you've got the overlap, if we were to just sort of, for a better term, Photoshop those four quadrants back together, they would form a sphere again and you basically got the mirrorable.
Amazing. Yeah, you really just like, it's like it was never cut up before. You just get the mirror ball image. And in fact, you do actually get a little bit of parallax between the two views, but it's only 1 centimeter of parallax on a very wide angle, not infinite resolution image. And it's impossible so far to notice any artifacts that you get from that.
Plus, you've got these two sort of crosses of the gray strip. Those are giving you some good point samples of what a diffuse ball would look like. And then I think I interrupted you before you got to the last stage, which is you then stick some colors on the sort of end of it as reference.
Yeah, we actually made it so that the fronts of these diffuse crosses actually have an area that all points straight toward the camera. And that allowed having a couple of flat color references. This is the result of chopping up a mini color checker chart and getting its red, green, and blue squares, as well as one of its gray squares that's approximately the reflectivity of our gray Rust-Oleum primer paint that we painted the rest of the strips with. So that if there's any question as to what the reflectivity of the main strips that we've got is, then we can just compare its intensity to the color checker, which is actually 30% reflective.
And one of the things that you and I discussed, I think last time I saw you in LA, was that while we can go to a lot of trouble to get a lot of accuracy with a fisheye lens doing HDRs or using mirror balls. In fact, one of the sort of weak spots in the equation can be what happens to the color space, because sometimes when people are putting HDRs together, the notion of what color space they're working is kind of lost. So having these RGB patches is actually incredibly useful, especially given that there'll be certain presumably chromatic kind of biases in the, whatever sensor of whatever camera is filming whatever you're doing.
Absolutely. I mean, there's the color of the illumination, and then there's how the camera is actually recording that. There's whatever filtration the cinematographer has put on the camera. You'd really like to be able to film the net result of that, and now you have reference right there in the scene as to what that whole process does to three color samples that we know where they should be in sRGB.
Now, you made a digital version of your probe in much the same way that we'll often make a digital gray ball and put it in just to see if the gray balls in the computer generated sense are matching the one that is in the photography. And you made a digital version of your probe to do the same thing, didn't you?
Yes, that was how we tried to validate, once we'd reconstructed the intensity of all the saturated light sources we could find. First of all, if we light a digital version of the probe, and we were actually using Matt Farr and Greg Humphrey's PBRT, physically based ray tracer, for these tests, just to make sure that a digital version of the probe looks, you know, pretty much pixel for pixel like the real photograph that we took of the probe. And you know, for the test cases that we did, it matched quite well.
And so if that's matching at a kind of a probe level, I think the proof here is in the pudding. You actually did some examples of, and you know, they were shown at SIGGRAPH, of actually rendering this with your probe, as in the one-shot probe, as well as a more traditional HDR series. And then you compared those two frames. Tell me how they look to your eye.
Well, there's actually an interesting story there, but I should back up one moment and explain that the other key thing that we did for the first time in this work compared to 9 years ago with the diffuse sphere is that for the first time we actually solved for the intensity of multiple saturated light sources in the scene. And our graduate student Paul Graham fired up MATLAB and ran the equations that basically, if you've identified, you know, in your mirrored sphere, once you stick that back together, you can see, oh, there's a saturated spot where that softbox was, and there's another saturated spot where that spotlight was. You actually have the ability to solve for both of those independently, as long as they're not coming from exactly the same direction. And that is simply it's just another series of linear equations where you put area lights in your scene that happen to be exactly the size and shape of the saturated regions in your probe, and then you solve as if every one of those, everything in that area is all the same intensity for how bright that light has to be and how bright that has to be in order for the diffuse strips on the virtual ball to end up resembling the intensities on the diffuse strips of the real single-shot light probe that we had. And in fact, it's quite simple, because we just sample the front of the single-shot light probe plus or minus 45 degrees on one diagonal and plus or minus 45 degrees on the other diagonal for its diffuse color. That gives us five answers to the diffuse integral in that direction has to be this, the diffuse integral in this other direction has to be this. You have, you know, five equations. If there's only two saturated lights, there's only two unknowns, you've got an overdetermined system of equations. And, you know, in barely any computation, you can accurately figure out what those light source colors and intensities need to be so that your virtual probe gets lit the same way as your real single-shot probe.
Let me just quickly translate one thing. When you say saturated, in my world, that would be a color term, but you mean like clipped in my term, don't you? Like when you say it's a saturated light source, it's...
I should be saying clipped, absolutely.
No, that's right.
Saturated is a sensor term where if you think of the little electron well that is filling up full of electrons as photons hit it on your CMOS sensor or your CCD, at some point it fills all the way up, and that's called the saturation point. And that's when clipping happens in the digital world.
So just to repeat then, so we've got these clipped or saturated light sources, the ones that obviously are beyond the dynamic range of the setup as it is. Though I think you were shooting these underexposed about a stop and a half?
Yeah, shooting a little bit underexposed is okay. You're still going to get your indirect light estimated just fine, because you know, it's a pretty bright specular reflection that we've got, and typically the specular reflections that you're observing on a digital object are going to be like off of plastic or off of skin. I think if you were doing a modern day Terminator robot, you might want to not underexpose for the probe. In that case, you know, both of the things are definitely within range, and you have enough pixels to avoid any issues you would have with noise with that.
Okay, so let me just clarify one thing that came up in the questions of the SIDGRAPH paper, and it just touches on the second point you made there right after that discussion about saturation, which is this idea that if I've got, I think in the SIDGRAPH paper it actually says if there are M equations equal to the number of irradiance samples with N unknown light sources, then as long as the number of those equations, the M number of equations, is greater than the N number of unknown lights, you're okay. Which leads me to question, I think somebody asked this question, that means there's actually a finite number of lights you can use for this technique to work, is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. So in theory, according to math, suppose that we just grab five samples off of our diffuse strips, then that means you could solve for up to five saturated light sources. What happens? There's a sixth saturated light source. What do we do? Well, what you could do is then put in a regularization term, which is an additional equation that says that these two light sources are the same color and intensity. So if there were two spotlights there that are the same make, you could say, oh, well, those two are probably the same color and intensity. And then it would force that into the solution. Or you could just say that lights that are close together are more likely to be similar intensity, and you could regularize the solution there. You could also take more samples off of the diffuse sphere. But if you did get into a pessimal condition where there were tons of little saturated light sources all over the place, and each one was its own unique, unexpected color and intensity, I think you'd have trouble solving for that. But the cool thing is that you would still solve for a lighting condition that its reflection off of a mirrored sphere would look the same as the photo that you took, and its reflection off of a diffuse sphere would look the same as the photo that you took. So even if it's wouldn't necessarily 100% accurate, it would still be indistinguishable from the actual lighting's effect on most objects you would put in the scene.
Paul, is this what mathematicians call failing elegantly?
Yes, it fails elegantly, exactly.
So let's just recap that. So I'm on a studio and I'm taking I've got something lit. If I've got three or four lights that are actually in the mirror ball reflected, and most of the studio would in fact be reflected. Another good point to note here is that a mirror ball actually reflects more than what you think it does. Most people would think it only reflects things in front of it, but actually it reflects most of the room. So they've got those four or five lights, and they are literally clipping on the ball or saturating as you're putting it. I could reconstruct this to the point of being able to use a physically plausible shader with physically plausible lights and really get this working. The only piece of information I think I'm missing at the moment from this is I couldn't reconstruct my lighting with anything other than a theoretical kind of dome solution or spherical solution, because I wouldn't have any way of knowing how far away those clipped or saturated light sources are, would I?
Absolutely. In this case, this lighting reconstruction approach, it doesn't get you any more information than would be available with an HDR series of a mirrored ball, one of the more traditional light probe approaches. So it would still be up to you to survey the set, you know, like we did for our Fiat Lux movie, projecting our probes onto the interior of St. Peter's Basilica to effectively get the light to come from the right point in space. So, you know, for our film, the dominoes falling over all were lit with light coming from about the right directions, and the reflections showing up coming in from the right directions. Digital Domain did a great job on the curious case of Benjamin Button, where I think they tended to shoot their probes with the 8mm fisheye on a full-frame sensor camera from a couple different directions. But they would survey their set with traditional survey techniques, total station kinds of things. And that rough geometry became what the probes were mapped onto. And you could even imagine getting, you know, one of these nice, you know, Ferrofocus 3D laser scanners in there to get your geometry really quick, and then putting the probes onto that as well.
Yeah, I think Sony's using the Spheron because it has a offset thing, so that literally it has a known offset. You run it twice, and effectively the known offset gives you the stereoscopic kind of solution you need to triangulate the positions of the lights. Though it's a different approach because it's like a photocopier. It scans around in a kind of a finite amount of time, as opposed to as I think the point of your exercise here is that, not to say this is necessarily the ultimate solution, though it's very, very good, but it certainly is the fastest solution I've ever heard of for being able to get this kind of stuff in a real-world practical sense. And if I can pay you the compliment, I'm stunned at how often you guys in ICT come up with not the academic, you know, theoretical, only works in a lab solution, but in this particular case, about the most practical and down-to-earth solution I've seen in this area.
Thank you for that. I mean, I think that's also a testament to the SIGGRAPH conference in the scope of work that they accept for presentation. Because, you know, actually, you know, in terms of the mathematical rigor of this particular work, it's a straightforward linear system of equations. It's nothing that's going to, you know, excite you know, even your mid-college calculus at this point. But, you know, it's still something that they were happy for us to present. And I think it's a good technique for, you know, definitely for, you know, human characters that you might be adding to a scene later, or creatures. I think for robots, you still might want a bit more resolution in the reflections than you're going to pull off of our mirrored ball, which doesn't get you any higher resolution than any mirrored ball would do. But I really think that for dropping a human character or a teddy bear, you know, or even a little lizard crawling around on the table or something like that, that this is everything you would need in terms of the lighting reconstruction to have it look correct and, you know, give your lighting artists, you know, the right thing to start with as they go, and then make it artistically really sing in terms of what the scene needs.
This was one of several papers presented on the same session at SIGGRAPH, and I commented in some of the stuff we've written about some of the other papers in that session. But I also wanted to pay you the compliment of saying that I attended one of the other lectures given by, I don't know if it was co-presented or just ICT, but it was after one of the Pixar presentations on hair, and it was on the work that you've been doing on the light stage for actually scanning facial hair as part of the scanning of faces. The team seemed to have done great work in actually getting from that information individual facial hair. So it's great to know that that research is also continuing.
Yeah, absolutely. That was Graham Fife's presentation there, and some work that he had done. He's been improving the stereo reconstruction techniques for our facial scanning approaches, and the best that we can do in the light stages. And he had made the observation that whenever there was stubble or hair or fuzz coming out of a face, that the stereo reconstruction errors were very predictable in terms of the kind of error that you would see in the stereo matching terms. And he had the thought that if we simply place, you know, these particles of hair where we're getting stereo matching issues, that would be a good way to start actually growing the hair that the subject might have had. And that sounded like a good idea to me. Actually, this last Halloween, I shaved my my goatee for my Halloween, and I realized this was just an epic chance for the first time in years to actually get my own face scan, because I had I was clean shaven for the first time in a long time. But with this kind of approach that Graham has presented, then, you know, you could actually just scan yourself and get your characteristic facial hair as well.
Yeah, and the reason I mentioned it is that, if I recall correctly, it was a comment made that current digital cameras could resolve a stubble on a face in this particular, in your rig, at I think it was about 3 pixels kind of resolution. And I just thought, when I was sitting there listening to the paper being presented, that it is great seeing these advances in sensors, and then sort of realizing that, of course, this is every time this happens, that has ramifications for what can be done in a sensible kind of way in the lab and elsewhere for this kind of reconstructive work. And certainly the results weren't approximations. You seem to be actually sort of identifying hairs as opposed to just, you know, putting a bunch of hair in where we knew hair sort of was.
Absolutely, yeah. If you see a nice hair on its own, then Graham is definitely going to nail that one. The main problems happen where, particularly like if you have a dense patch of very dark hair, that finally it's a little bit too hard to see what's going on in amongst the noise of the camera sensor. But it's a very good point that you make that so many of the advances that we're able to achieve are not just trying to come up with, you know, better algorithms. Certainly we're doing some of that, but, you know, the quality of the digital imagery that you can get even on a, you know, less than $1,000 camera these days is absolutely phenomenal. I remember, you know, when I got my first digital camera, it was a Kodak DCS 520. It cost $15,000. It was 1728 by 1152 pixels, so 2 megapixels. And if you tried to take an exposure even, you know, up to a second, you would get a useless amount of noise down in the shadow regions, and we're just amazingly far beyond that at this point.
Yes, I think the work that we've been talking about today, the test imagery came off Canon, I'm going to say 1D Mark III, but I know myself I'm using the 5D Mark III, and the level of ISO that I can go up to and get a relatively low noise image must make you very happy.
Yeah, we're very happy. We're testing some of the newer cameras right now, and you can definitely get a better signal to noise ratio than what the when the Mark III's are that we've used in the past. So we're excited to be having opportunities to work with better and better equipment. Absolutely.
Well, again, I just wanted to say thanks for joining us, and also just to comment on how there seems to be such a good team with USC's ICT. Obviously, we've been talking to you today, but in fact, the papers that we've been referring to, you weren't personally presenting, and you seem to have a really good team now, quite a large setup that you've got going there.
We have our research group, we have a couple of grad students, we have a couple of full-time staff, and then we have our producer and our coordinator, and, you know, we're very happy taking up our little corner of the third floor of the ICT, and to have the opportunity to do this work that excites us a lot, and, you know, gives us a chance to interface to lots of other people who are truly doing absolutely cutting edge work in the computer graphics industry. So,
because it seemed like you had more people than that. Because how many papers did you have in SIDGRAPH? You were co-authored with?
I think our group got up to present about 6 times this time.
Wow, well,
and it was I guess I think a little bit of a cheeky scheduling trick that the SIGGRAPH committee did, putting 5 of them in the same session.
Well, I can tell you that was a session I sat through. I enjoyed it immensely. But Paul, let me just swing back. You did make a teasing remark earlier that there was some interesting anecdote in comparing the actual image that you got using the new light probe with one that actually I think came off 7 bracketed shots. I need to find out what that was about.
Yeah, so it's important when you try to present a new technique to try to compare to sort of the standard technique that's out there. So when we set up our office environment with the spotlight and the softbox light, we not only shot our single shot probe, but we also put my one remaining uncut apart chrome sphere in there, and then shot a full HDR series. I think I had the camera at f8 or f11 and shot it, you know, everywhere from a half second all the way down to a 4,000th of a second. So it wouldn't have been easy to go any darker than that. And then another test object that we had in the scene was a black plastic sphere, which we also shot in HDR. This is me and my grad student, Paul Graham, working late one night. And the idea was to reconstruct the lighting off of the traditional chrome ball and then compare that to what we reconstructed on the single shot probe. And the funny thing is that when it came time to reconstruct the traditional chrome ball image series, to my embarrassment, I looked at the shortest exposure of that chrome ball. And since that spotlight we put in there was a 1K mini Mole Richardson, pretty much aimed straight at the ball, even in that shortest exposure, it was still a little bit saturated right in the middle of that light. And
radiometrically, that means you've just blown it. You don't know. Those pixel values theoretically could have been anything, and you just simply didn't record what that light was. And I was kind of upset and realized, oh my gosh, we didn't get good validation against current techniques. But fortunately, that black sphere that was in the scene shows something that's about four stops down or so from the mirrored sphere. And so by radiometrically relating that area of the sphere to how bright that was compared to the chrome ball, I could make a virtual final exposure that didn't saturate for that HDR series and reconstruct the chrome ball as if it didn't saturate. And then that actually compared very favorably, in fact, you know, visually identically to what the single shot probe did. But it also underscored the point that, you know, maybe it's not as easy to just go out and properly shoot an HDR series of a mirrored ball to do lighting reconstruction if even us under laboratory conditions actually managed to screw it up.
You weren't just tempted to walk down the hall and re-photograph another set of HDRs?
Well, we'd done it a couple weeks ago.
Okay.
It's, actually, what really happened is I was out traveling and we were coming up against the deadline and I was Skyping to Paul Graham and realizing that our goose was a little cooked if we didn't figure out some way to get it to work with what we had. And then finally an idea occurred.
Well, I guess necessity is the mother of invention. But yeah, I mean, look, the bottom line, of course, is that the two images, to my eye anyway, are virtually identical between the image that came from the new light probe, which would have been, I think, safe to say, pretty much, well, to use I don't mean to sound derogatory, but it's virtually idiot-proof in the sense that you just have to take one shot of it and something that you have to spend a bit more time doing as an HDR probe. I hope I didn't just call you, Paul Dubovic, an idiot on air. If I did, I apologize. But yeah,
that's okay. And to underscore that point, we have had one chance to actually use it out in semi production, which is that just a couple weeks before SIGGRAPH, I got a call from some people over at Richard Edlund's visual effects company that they were doing a shoot up in Malibu. And they were wondering if I could come up and help advise on how they were, you know, shooting their light probes over there. And so, of course, you know, the chance to go hang out in Malibu with Richard Edlund et al. Is an exciting thing. So I had no trouble to go up there. And I actually brought some of my own equipment and the single shot probe. And just at the end, I got a photo of me and Richard with him holding the probe, just thinking that this would be a nice photo to have for posterity. And in fact, Paul Graham was able to take that very photograph, which was not intended at all for lighting reconstruction, and the probe only shows up about 100 pixels wide in the 4K photo I shot just with my digital ELF, you know, Canon S100, and was able to reconstruct the lighting and virtually light a Utah teapot and render it into the scene with the light that was there with me and Richard.
I've seen that picture, and yes, I think there were two versions to tell, if truth be told. You put one in it, and then somebody, I think, had the idea to make it turn around so it looks like Richard was actually pouring with the teapot.
Indeed, it looked a little less floating there, because, of course, again, we had no intention to actually light the thing. And of course, you know, lighting is very important to make an object look like it's in the scene, but there's a couple of other things, like getting the camera perspective right and making it look like the actor is actually holding it or interacting, that are a little bit more important to get right first. But, you know, the lighting's important too.
So thanks again, Paul, for talking to us. Really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Great to talk with you, as always.
Well, thanks to Mike and to Paul for that. I'm sure all of us are anxious to see where this research goes and anything we can do to speed up the processes and make our lives easier with achieving high-quality results is, of course, always welcome. Well, that'll do it for this podcast. Before we go, I'd just like to talk about our FX Insider program. It's our membership program that gives access to special, more in-depth members-only content. You can find out more details at fxguide.com. Click the FX Insider tab. You've been listening to the FX Podcast. In addition to this podcast, we do two other regular audio podcasts. The VFX Show reviews visual effects in current releases, as well as classic films. And the RC Podcast covers the ever-changing landscape of digital cinematography. If you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd also recommend our high-definition video podcast, FX Guide TV. You can find all of these along with in-depth articles, news, and more at fxguide.com. We also have a sister site, fxphd.com, that offers extensive online visual effects training. If you haven't been over in a while, you might want to check out what we're offering over there. We've also expanded our options for how many classes you can take, from the high end to the low end, a little more variety in the pricing options. So check that out over at fxphd.com. Well, for my partners Mike Seymour and John Montgomery, this is Jeff Huser. We'll see you on the next FX Podcast.
Please let us know if you have any suggestions for stories or future podcasts. You can reach us by clicking the Contact Us link at the top of the homepage. This podcast is copyright FX Guide, LLC. Broadcast or redistribution is prohibited without the expressed written consent of FX Guide.